Content warning. This episode of Single Malt History contains some sexual language, and listener discretion is advised. Information, disclaimer, and notice. There is much debate among experts about the ancient Egyptian period, the topic of today's episode. And in order to prevent this episode from becoming too historiographical in focus, where possible, I have accepted what I think to be the most probable sequence of events. Although I must note, errors and contentions, of course, will remain in any piece of ancient history. I've tried to use the translations that are most accurate, as well as to convey Hatshepsut's life in the best narrative fashion I can, with the evidence and the fascinating debates that are available to me. Welcome to Single Malt History with Gareth Russell, pouring out your serving of pure, distilled, intoxicating, and occasionally delicious history. As the sun beat down on southern Egypt in the late 16th century BC, prayers wafted up with the incense in the temples to Hapi, hermaphrodite god of the Nile. The statues of Hapi with their penises and pendulous breasts reflected the Egyptian belief that the great river Nile was a self-sustaining organism, a river that could fertilize itself year after year while also flooding to fill the riverbank farms with nutrients through the dark mud that made a good Egyptian harvest possible. As the priests to Hapi prayed in their temples, the great river itself flowed past outside, cutting through the Egyptian capital city of Thebes. On the river, fishermen worked from their skiffs as messengers were carried to and fro from both sides of the riverbank in ferries, passing the fishermen's skiffs and the barges of the aristocracy, from which floated the sounds of music and laughter as the wealthiest residents of Thebes took to the river to find a breeze or to hunt. Shrines dotted the riverbank to the crocodile god Sobek, praying for protection from his lethal liegemen who lived in the River Nile that was the cause of death for many Egyptians and the sustenance of life for all of them. The only thing more ubiquitous to Egyptian life than the river was the sun, and it was in Thebes that the worship of the greatest of the Egyptian gods, Amun-Ra, reached its apogee. The temple to Amun at Karnak was, and remains to this day, the largest religious site of worship ever constructed. Centuries before, when the Egyptian capital had been in the north at the northern city of Memphis, near to where the pyramids had been built, Amun had been a minor southern god, and the king of the Egyptian gods then was the sun god Ra, sometimes translated into English as Re. I hope I'm not reducing the debate too much, the reason why you will sometimes see it written in English books as Ra and other times as Re is because I think there is quite a big debate among Egyptologists about how to translate or transliterate vowels from ancient Egyptian into European languages, and particularly English, which is why sometimes you'll get an A and sometimes an E in the translations. So sometimes Ra, sometimes Re. As the centuries wore on and different branches of the royal family came to power, the Egyptian monarchy's heartlands shifted south, eventually settling in Thebes as the new capital city, and so Thebes's minor local god Amun was thus elevated to the national god and merged with the old northern sun god Ra to become Amun-Ra. In his great temple at Thebes, Karnak, Amun was worshipped alongside his wife, the mother goddess Mut. Lakes were constructed at the temple for the priests and priestesses to ritually bathe themselves every morning before they began the worship of Amun. Vast amounts of food were brought in before the sacred golden statue of Amun. Gold was believed to be the flesh of the gods. As hymns were sung and the offered food then consumed by the temple staff, Amun's beloved servants. Often, the priests at Karnak would be joined in their services by Queen Amose. The ancient Egyptian monarchy did not really seem to have a direct equivalent, or sorry, at least not a direct easy translation of the word queen, though of course Egyptologists writing later have felt comfortable using it as it's the closest transliteration. Queen Amose was in fact a queen among queens. Her technical title was the Great Royal Wife, indicating that she was the chief of the pharaoh's wives. As Queen Amose, Great Royal Wife, beloved of Pharaoh, walked forward to begin intoning hymns to the god Amun, she was as much a priestess among priestesses as she was queen among queens. She was Queen Amose, she who is great of praises. Amose, the lady of great beloved sweetness. Amose, the mistress of gladness. Amose, the beloved of Horus. Horus being the falcon-headed god of the royal family, who had, in Egyptian legend, ruled the country as a god on earth in the centuries after creation before he went to join his parents in the next world. That very famous single eye that many of us will still associate as one of the most easily recognizable symbols of ancient Egypt was called the Eye of Horus. Queen Amose's many titles, some of which I've just referenced, attested to her prominence at the heart of the reborn Egyptian monarchy. Amun, according to Egyptian theology, was reborn each day as the sun rose. His daily rebirth and Egypt's political rebirth were inextricably linked in the public's mind. Only two generations earlier, Egypt had been broken and divided, the northern half of the kingdoms occupied by a foreign imposed government. They were known as the Hyksos. We don't know exactly who the Hyksos invaders were. We do know that they introduced chariots to Egypt for the first time. The Hyksos' skill with them and the Egyptians' initial lack of chariots helped explain the scale and speed of the Hyksos' military victories. Hyksos comes from the Egyptian term for the invaders, Hekakasut, meaning rulers from the foreign lands. A possible answer, certainly a credible theory, is that the Hyksos may have been Canaanites, but even that remains contested. They had been expelled during a series of wars and Egypt reunified by Pharaoh Amos I, who pledged himself to the protection of the god Amun, who was credited with many of the subsequent victories that reunified Egypt. The late Pharaoh Amos and his great royal wife, Queen Amose Nefertari, were still popularly venerated as god and goddess after their deaths, even more so than most pharaohs. As Queen Amose returned from the great temple to the great palace, it cannot have been lost on her that, unlike her namesake, the first Queen Amose, she had not given birth to a son to continue the dynasty. The monarchy's permission for polygamy had taken that pressure off the queen to a great deal, in that her husband had a son, whom he had fathered with one of his lesser wives, the princess Mutnufret. Still, if Queen Amose outlived her husband, her future political and social position would be a lot more secure if she had a son who succeeded as pharaoh. As the sun set over Thebes, the moon that had given the queen her name appeared. Amose meant the moon is born, and it cast its silver light over the capital city's other great temple to the god Khonsu, god of the moon and of healing, son of Amun and Mut. Whether Queen Amose prayed to her lunar protector to grant her a son, we don't know, but it may have been, given her name, that a statue of Khonsu was present in the queen's rooms in the palace when she went into labour in 1507. The statues of the other traditional childbirth gods and goddesses would very likely have been moved into the queen's rooms to keep her safe as she squatted on the bricks used by most ancient Egyptian women during childbirth. Bes, sometimes known as the dwarf god, the beloved god of protecting the home, stared in statue form at the screaming, labouring queen. There was also a statue of beautiful Nephthys, a goddess of the night and of childbirth, a statue of Hecate, the frog goddess of fertility, worshipped because of the ease with which female frogs give birth to so many, and a statue of the hideous Great One, Tawarat, the hippopotamus goddess with pendulous human breasts and a crocodile tail, venerated as the lady of the birthing house. The gods and the midwives kept Queen Imhotep safe, and she lived to hold her daughter, the princess Hatshepsut, in her arms. And they did the same a few years later when Imhotep gave birth to another daughter, the princess Nefertiti. Just as a heads up, if I get through this episode and the only thing I tripped up over was the word crocodile tail, and I get through all of the Egyptian names, I will be absolutely incandescent with rage. Documentation is scarce for this period, so we don't actually know, even from the temple carvings, who Queen Imhotep was in society before she was the great royal wife. It has been suggested by several Egyptologists, and this does seem the most likely theory to my mind, that Imhotep had some royal blood, perhaps being the niece or the cousin of a previous pharaoh. It seems that her husband, Pharaoh Thutmosis I, had been an army general with a strong dose of royal blood before he was chosen to become pharaoh on the death of Pharaoh Amenhotep I, who seems to have died without sons. It is possible that upon taking the throne, Thutmosis married a distant relative in the form of Princess Imhotep to shore up his claim to the throne of the two lands, as Egypt was called, northern and southern, lower and upper. The princesses Hatshepsut and Nefertiti grew up within the palace confines, likely shaved bald when they were infants, which was the custom with Egyptian children. Princess Nefertiti may still not have graduated to adult hair when she died young. Queen Imhotep seems to have placed a huge amount of effort and time into her daughter Hatshepsut's education. Hatshepsut was literate, no mean feat given the complexity of hieroglyphs and even of hieratic, the easier everyday form of writing in ancient Egypt. The princess also learned the glories of her ancestry, music, politics, and theology. Theology was particularly important. Because Queen Imhotep and Pharaoh Thutmosis intended Princess Hatshepsut to one day succeed her mother as God's wife, or chief priestess, that's what God's wife meant, of Amun. They also intended Hatshepsut to succeed her mother Imhotep as Egypt's queen by marrying Hatshepsut to her elder brother, or rather her half-brother, the heir to the throne, Prince Thutmosis. Egyptian royalty married siblings to each other on and off over the course of the civilization's three millennia of existence. At different times, these sibling marriages meant different things. We know that in some generations, the marriages of royal brothers to their sisters were purely symbolic, and the children were produced with another non-related partner. For instance, the last Egyptian royal family, the Greek-descended Ptolemies, who produced Egypt's most famous pharaoh, Cleopatra VII, seem to have practiced sibling marriages more as a ritual than as a reality. We do, however, know that at other points in Egyptian history, these marriages were real and full, meaning that they were consummated. For instance, Egypt's second most famous pharaoh, Tutankhamun, married his half-sister, Queen Ankhesenamun, and they produced at least two pregnancies together, the miscarried fetuses from which were embalmed and placed as mummies in their father's tomb. Why? Well, these marriages of the royal siblings, incestuous at some points and purely symbolic at others, were designed to mirror the foundational birth stories of the Egyptian religion. The Egyptian creation myth ran that in the time before times there had been nothing but the waters of chaos, from which had emerged the creator god Atum. Some later identified this god as Amun or Ra or Amun-Ra. The story was ancient and shifting. But whether you use the name Atum, Amun or Ra, the god who begat himself arose from the waters of chaos. And having no mate, this god masturbated the universe into existence. As his ejaculate erupted, it helped form the next two gods, Shu and Tefnut, gods of the elements. Shu, the dry god, and Tefnut, the wet goddess, were siblings who then mated to produce two more children, siblings, Geb, the god of earth, and Nut, the goddess of the skies. If you're familiar with some Egyptian art or tomb work, you may have already seen the goddess Nut as the woman who's often seen sort of arching her body over a scene, and her body's covered with stars. That's the traditional depiction of Nut. So Geb and Nut, earth and sky, then mated to produce this time four children. Osiris, king of the underworld, who married his sister and queen, the goddess Isis. Their brother Seth, the god of destruction, who married their sister, the aforementioned goddess of the night, Nephthys. Just as Osiris and Isis ruled in the world beyond as pharaoh and queen, brother and sister, husband and wife, so should the pharaohs in this world replicate the divine union of the sibling gods. In 1493, when Princess Hatshepsut was about 15 or 16 years old, her father, Thutmosis I, died. Many centuries earlier, the Egyptians in the north had buried the pharaohs in great pyramids. The cost of building the pyramids was ruinous, the creation was lengthy, and the later pharaohs thus preferred to be buried somewhere where they and their treasure could be more discreetly and easily hidden from greedy, blasphemous grave robbers. Thutmosis I was taken, mummified, deep into a valley outside the capital city, the Valley of the Kings, where he was buried in a tomb chiseled and hidden deep into the rocks. And this cave tomb, painted with scenes to guide the pharaoh to Osiris's kingdom beyond, was called his mansion of a million years. Thutmosis I's death passed the crown to his son Thutmosis II, aged about 18. He married his half-sister, as Hatshepsut replaced her remarkable mother as great royal wife in the palace and god's wife of Amun in the temple. The duties of being a great royal wife were enormous, complex, and important, especially in an empire still culturally and economically stabilizing itself after the expulsion of the Hyksos invaders. We have mentioned that pharaohs like Tutankhamun did have some incestuous relationships, and Hatshepsut, quite interestingly, came from the same family as Tutankhamun, albeit distantly. He was her five times great nephew. There can be no doubt that Thutmosis II and Hatshepsut did have a sexual relationship during their marriage, because Queen Hatshepsut gave birth to their daughter, Princess Neferure. Although most Egyptian homes were monogamous, all could legally be polygamous if they wanted to, and most pharaohs chose to be in order to safeguard the succession. It may be, however, that Hatshepsut and Thutmosis II slept together infrequently, or that, understandably, given how close their genetic relationship was, they struggled to sustain pregnancies. There are no recorded children after Princess Neferure for them. Either way, Thutmosis II had a secondary wife, the Lady Iset, by whom he fathered a son who was given his name, Thutmosis, which means born of Thoth, Thoth being the Egyptian god of wisdom. This is purely speculative on my part, but it is interesting to note that as she grew in influence, Hatshepsut was to try to edge her dynasty away from the incestuous marriages. The evidence for this is circumstantial, and it might be unwise to read too much into the fact that she and her brother husband Thutmosis II only produced one child together. There may have been miscarriages which were unrecorded. However, it is interesting that Hatshepsut does not seem to have borne any animus towards nor concern about her nephew's stepson, Prince Thutmosis. And when the time came, she did not apparently follow her parents' actions by betrothing her daughter, Princess Neferure, to her brother. Her education stood Hatshepsut in great stead for the life she now led as Egypt's queen. Thutmosis II left her in control of the government when he led the armies south to crush a rebellion. The province of Kush, located in what is today North Sudan, had risen up against the pharaoh, who returned to Thebes amid celebratory parades after he crushed the insurrection. The royals made more donations in architecture to beautify Amun's colossal temple at Karnak following the victory in Kush. And there was another triumph when Thutmosis II went north to wage war against the Bedouin in Sinai. Thutmosis II's military achievements were all the more remarkable when one considers that he had probably started to suffer from severe ill health in his 20s, perhaps even earlier. His mummy shows that he suffered from a painful skin condition and that he was potentially wasting away, in which case Thutmose II's decline seems to have augmented Hatshepsut's role in government. As daughter of the previous pharaoh and wife of the current one, as well as Amun's god's wife on earth, Hatshepsut was always going to be important in Egyptian politics. But Thutmose II's military campaigns and his physical decline made a woman who had been important evolve into someone who was central. Along with her duties overseeing the government, appearing in public, and leading the ritual worship of Amun at Karnak, Hatshepsut also had time to enjoy the great luxury available to the Egyptian royal family, which only grew in splendour as the empire rebirthed by her ancestor continued to grow. Like many women in the Egyptian elite, Hatshepsut would have had wigs for many occasions. Summer wigs were lighter than the more elaborate winter wigs, and sometimes fragranced wax would be situated in them to slowly melt at parties, emitting a beautiful scent. She would have gone on river cruises where she and her entourage were entertained by bare-breasted dancers and singers. Like her mother Amose had with her, Hatshepsut took great care of her daughter Neferure's education. She picked a tutor for the princess called Senenmut, the intellectually brilliant offspring of a lower-class family from a town just south of the capital. Hatshepsut had proved herself shrewd, intelligent, and competent, as well as being the wealthiest and most powerful woman in Egypt. When aged about 28, the ground shifted beneath her. After about 13 or 14 years on the throne, her husband Thutmosis II died and went to join their ancestors, entombed in his House of a Million Years. It cannot have been much of a surprise given the pharaoh's health struggles, but his death still altered Hatshepsut's life permanently and profoundly. For 70 days, Egypt was in mourning as the pharaoh's body was mummified and prepared for his tomb. As Thutmosis II began his journey to the land of the dead, the Duat, Hatshepsut made no objection to the proclamation of her stepson as the new pharaoh, Thutmosis III. The new pharaoh was 12 years old, too young just to assume control of the government in his own name. With her previous experience, the Dowager Queen Hatshepsut assumed control as regent, caretaker of the crown, until her stepson reached adulthood. The boy king's biological mother, the Lady Iset, could enjoy a life of a lot of luxury and absolutely no political importance while Hatshepsut took the reins. The transition of the crown happened smoothly, peacefully. But having been at the centre of things all her adult life, Queen Hatshepsut had no intention of receding into anonymity once Thutmosis was old enough to rule himself. She had her daughter, Princess Neferure, succeed her as God's wife of Amun. But she seems to have made no moves to marry Neferure to her brother Thutmosis. Thutmosis instead married, as his chief wife, a courtier, not a royal, called the Lady Satia. Whether this decision to prevent her daughter Neferure's wedding indicates Hatshepsut's distaste for the incest of her own marriage, we don't know. It is equally possible that Hatshepsut was already manoeuvring to ensure her stepson did not have a legitimately royal wife that would have added to his prestige and thereby made him more of a threat to her. It could have been a combination of both motivations. The obvious thing to do, as her plans to hold on to power solidified, would be for Hatshepsut to get rid of her stepson, either with poison or in some kind of prearranged accident. But Hatshepsut did not do this. Nor did she shunt her stepson to one side by keeping Tutmosis deliberately uneducated and thus unable to challenge her. In fact, aunt and nephew, stepmother and stepson, had an excellent relationship. Unlike his late father, Tutmosis III was strong, healthy, intelligent, and virile. Evidently, Hatshepsut ensured that Tutmosis continued his education in military matters, improving his physical fitness and his lessons in theology and government. He had a prominent role at her court, but it was her court, and she wanted to keep it that way. As she approached her 30th year, Hatshepsut hit on a revolutionary plan that ensured she would not have to relinquish power once her stepson became an adult. Pharaohs were almost always men, but it was almost. 400 years earlier, Queen Sobekneferu had declared herself pharaoh after the death of her husband, Pharaoh Amenemhat IV. Legend said that Queen Setibor had done the same thing in the age of the pyramids, as had Queen Meretneith at the dawn of Egyptian history, 15 centuries before Hatshepsut. At some point, not long after her husband's death, Hatshepsut decided to do the same. She would cease to be queen. Instead, she would assume the title of pharaoh and rule in her own name, not as God's wife, but as a woman king, a living god on earth. To do this, Hatshepsut enlisted the help of the Karnak priesthood. She certainly had the connections there to do that, having been God's wife at the temple for over a decade, and then installing her loyal daughter in the role after her. The priests of Amun loyally began to preach that Amun himself had chosen Hatshepsut to be pharaoh, declaring her publicly to be Amun's chosen and favourite daughter. Pharaohs were said to be the incarnations of the gods in weakened human form, but several pharaohs before Hatshepsut had gone farther than that, to say that a god had inhabited their earthly father's body at the moment of their conception. This kind of story had been told by earlier pharaohs like the celebrated warrior king Sindriset III. Hatshepsut, who was to prove herself one of the most brilliant masters of propaganda and the written word in ancient history, harnessed this tradition to her advantage. The story henceforth preached from the Karnak Temple and then all the temples throughout Egypt was that Amun had physically been present at the conception of Hatshepsut. Whether he achieved this by possessing or inhabiting the body of her earthly father, Tutmosis I, was left unclear. One of these surviving texts describes the divine sexual encounter between the god Amun and Hatshepsut's mother, Queen Amose. It reads, "He found her in the harem of her palace, where she awoke because of the fragrance of the god. She smiled, seeing his majesty, and he went right up to her, desiring her and loving her. He let her see him in his form as a god after he came unto her. She was exultant at seeing his beauties, and the love of him overtook her entire body. The palace was then flooded with the fragrance of the god, all his pleasant odours. The majestic power of this god did all that he wanted with her. She placed his body upon hers." The theology of Hatshepsut's specifically divine origins was then elaborated with the detail that during Queen Amose's pregnancy with her, Amun had gone to one of the creator gods, Khnum, and told him to mould Hatshepsut on his divine potter's wheel, literally kneaded into being and into perfection on the instructions of one god and at the hands of another. Hatshepsut was then born in human form, to grow in brilliance, beauty, and blessings until the gods called her husband to the underworld and delivered a sacred message to her, revealing that she, as Amun's daughter, was to take the throne in her own name. As this story, this justification, this version of events was chiseled onto temple walls the length and breadth of Egypt, Hatshepsut made her move by ditching the title of queen, or the Egyptian equivalent, and proclaiming herself co-pharaoh with her stepson. Thutmose III would legally remain pharaoh. She did not depose or dispossess him. But she would rule at his side. Legally. In reality, Thutmose III would continue to be his stepmother aunt's underling until she died. Having proclaimed herself pharaoh alongside Thutmose, Hatshepsut would, like all pharaohs, be in control until she joined her ancestors in death. But just as Hatshepsut took no drastic actions against Thutmose III, it's also true that despite the old legend that he hated her, there is in fact no evidence that Thutmose III resented his stepmother or even disliked her at all. He was taught government at her side. He flourished at the palace and in the army, and he seems to have waited relatively patiently until the day when he would rule on his own. Young Thutmose did his duty for the dynasty too, by producing a son, Prince Amenemhat, with his wife Queen Setia. Thutmose then took a secondary wife, the Lady Meretre Hatshepsut, daughter of a high-ranking priestess. Meretre Hatshepsut's second name reflects the priesthood's loyalty to Hatshepsut, while her family ties suggests the closeness that Thutmose was prepared to embark upon with his stepmother's allies. Thutmose and his second wife produced six children, the princes Amenhotep and Menkheperre, and the princesses Nebechunet, Meretamun, and Iset. The princesses were, like the pharaoh herself, educated thoroughly, especially in theology, with Nebechunet possibly growing up to serve as a high priestess of Hathor, the goddess of love and beauty, and the princesses Iset and Meretamun following in the family tradition of serving as high priestesses to Amun. Thutmose also had two further lesser wives, possibly concubines, called the Lady Nebtu and the Lady Nebseme, for whom he seems to have had quite strong feelings. It is unclear if he had children with either. The palace was alive with the sound of her stepson's growing family, and the dynasty was secure. Hatshepsut's stepson led the army, and her daughter led the greatest of the temples. Hatshepsut embarked comfortably upon the task of ruling in her own name. It is possible that around this time she had to go into mourning again for the death of her mother, the Dowager Queen Amose. Her grief, however, did not distract Hatshepsut from the fact that she had to ensure her coup lasted. Statues of Hatshepsut from this point in her life show her in outfits almost as deliberately androgynous as the Nile god Hapi. She no longer wears female royal insignia, as she is no longer God's wife nor queen. She is pharaoh. She appears wearing male crowns with the pharaoh's scepters and symbols of office. Her chest, though bare like most pharaohs in their statues, nonetheless often shows female anatomy. She is distinctly both, without diminishing either. Like Hapi, Hatshepsut has become a being unto herself. Like the pharaohs before her, she is a conduit of the gods, unlike most of them, in fact, unlike all of them. She is Amun's living daughter. As pharaoh, Hatshepsut prioritized prosperity, and she began by thanking Amun for choosing her to rule. The Temple of Karnak was expanded beyond its already enormous boundaries, with new gates and obelisks erected on the pharaoh's orders to honour Amun and his wife, the mother goddess Mut. It is not clear if Hatshepsut made any sizable bequests to the temple of Amun and Mut's son Khonsu, who technically was now Hatshepsut's celestial half-brother. And it's not clear because much of the surviving temple of Khonsu was rebuilt in the reign of a later pharaoh, Ramesses III. So if Hatshepsut did add anything, it might have been renovated out of existence by Ramesses III. Hatshepsut was nothing if not devout, and at least one of her biographers have suggested that she quite seriously seems to have believed in her divine mission. We can never know if it was piety or opportunism that fueled Hatshepsut's devotion to Amun, but like many such cases, I suspect it's probably simplistic to assume it needs to be one or the other. It's quite possible that, as with many people, a sense of destiny became symbiotic with a sense of faith, a self-fulfilling creative self-belief that grew stronger with each sign that fate, the will of the gods, had blessed each of Hatshepsut's actions. And she made sure to check or proclaim that Amun blessed every major idea she had. Long before Hatshepsut was born, before Egypt had fallen to the Hyksos invasions, some of the mightiest pharaohs had set up trade routes to a land that the Egyptians called Punt. We don't know exactly where Punt was located, as it's unlikely that this was anything but the Egyptian name for the kingdom. But the best modern scholarship indicates that Punt lay roughly where Somalia is presently located. Determined to revive this ancient trade route, Hatshepsut invested a huge amount of government money into building a fleet, a trading fleet for the Red Sea. This was innovative, as since the collapse of the Punt trade routes centuries earlier, Egyptians had shown almost no interest in seafaring. They focused on the Nile rather than the Red Sea to their east, or the Mediterranean, the Great Green Sea, they called it, to their north. To send a fleet 1,000 or so miles south for a people not used to seafaring was a risk, to put it mildly. But the priesthood at Karnak announced that the oracle of Amun had spoken, instructing Hatshepsut to search out the way onto Punt, open the roads to the terraces of Mur, bring the miracles of God's country to this god who has created Pharaoh's beauty. Hatshepsut entrusted the mission to a northern Egyptian called Nehesi, and her trust in Nehesi and her investment paid off. The Punt expedition was a triumph that she remained proud of for the rest of her life. It returned to Egypt with myrrh, frankincense trees, incense, ebony, rare bounty, and wood. As we have seen, the fragrance or scent of the gods was important in the Egyptians' religion, and Hatshepsut underscored the point by rubbing some of the rediscovered incense over her body. It is inscribed, "With her two hands, Her Majesty herself put the finest myrrh upon her entire body. Her perfume is the fragrance of the gods. Her odour is mixed with that of Punt. Her skin is gilded with fine gold, shining forth as do the stars in the great wide festival court before the gaze of the entire land." As the pharaoh went from strength to strength in her political life, do we know anything about her private life? Well, we don't know much about it after she became king. European scholars have sometimes compared her to Egypt's Elizabeth I. But the idea that she must have been a virgin queen or celibate as a widow pharaoh is totally unnecessary. Priestesses were not required to be celibate in ancient Egypt, as they would be in other cultures like ancient Rome, where the cult of the goddess Vesta was to put a near lethal preoccupation on some of its priestesses' chastity. There is no reason to assume that Hatshepsut could not have enjoyed an active sexual or romantic life as pharaoh if she wanted to. This is a quote about Hatshepsut's private life from Dr. Karakuni's biography of her, The Woman Who Would Be King, which is a fascinating read. Dr. Kuni writes, "It is quite likely that Hatshepsut had lovers, affairs, trysts, whatever we want to call them. All the academic speculation about Senenmut being Hatshepsut's lover seems rather silly, as if this man were her only opportunity for an affair. Given her position of power and her lack of husband, she could have had relationships with any number of officials, young or old, male or female. Why would we expect Hatshepsut to have embraced celibacy? When she took lovers, did her courtiers look the other way, or were her attachments openly acknowledged and welcomed at court meals and parties? Did she love any of her men or women? Did she ever have a real partner with whom she could share anxieties or talk through strategies?" And that's from Dr. Karakuni's book, The Woman Who Would Be King. Of course, we don't know, but I think Dr. Cooney is right in pointing out that although as ruler she was alone, that did not necessarily mean Hatshepsut was lonely. Who was the man Senenmut, who Dr. Cooney suggests has wrongly been identified by historians as Hatshepsut's long-term lover? He was Princess Neferire's former tutor, who, after Hatshepsut seized the throne, rose to become one of the most influential men in the new pharaoh's government. Did Senenmut's rapid rise to prominence indicate that he was the pharaoh's lover? Possibly. His origins were, as mentioned, not just non-royal, but non-aristocratic. Senenmut came from a large, apparently very loving, lower-class family in an unimportant town south of Thebes. His parents, like the majority of the population, were illiterate. And quite touchingly, I think, one of Senenmut's acts after making his fortune was to open up his parents' tomb so that he could rebury them somewhere more grand and with more possessions for them in the underworld. Having appointed him as her daughter's tutor, Hatshepsut had known Senenmut for years, and he had evidently made a good impression. Neferire seems to have been devoted to him too. However, Dr. Cooney is correct when she points out that not only was Senenmut hardly the only figure with whom Pharaoh Hatshepsut could have had an affair had she wanted, but also that a sexual liaison with the pharaoh isn't the only possible explanation for Senenmut's rise to become one of her right-hand men or chief advisors. Senenmut rose from tutor to steward to architect, and it was his brilliance in architecture that paved the path to Hatshepsut's favour. Because she was a builder pharaoh, one of the most prodigious in Egyptian history. In her quest to further beautify the temples of Amun, Hatshepsut recruited the best men and paid for the best materials. Senenmut's first big project in that regard seems to have been the two obelisks Hatshepsut commissioned for the Karnak temple courtyards. The obelisks were tall, needle-like structures with a pyramid-style top. Each of their four surfaces could be carved with hieroglyphs proclaiming a pharaoh or deity's deeds. Sourcing an obelisk, transporting it, and installing it showcased ancient Egypt's impressive skills and infrastructure, but they are not without dangers. Just as some of the first tries with the pyramids had, which never featured, very seldom featured in documentaries, just as some of the first tries with the pyramids had led to collapses and fallen sides, obelisks could often go wrong. As Hatshepsut learned when her scouts found a perfect slab of granite in the quarry at Aswan, as they started to chisel away to extract it, the perfect slab cracked, and they had to move on to find another of the right size and in the right location. No easy task. A single perfect piece of pink granite weighing 343 tons was found, chiseled to be extracted, moved on vast wooden rollers with hundreds of workers, taken to a canal, rolled onto special sturdy transport ships, and shipped slowly to the great temple of Amun. Known as the Obelisk of Hatshepsut, it was to be the largest obelisk ever erected in ancient Egypt. Thanks to an archaeological effort, it is now once again standing in the temple, 97 feet tall, after falling over many years after Hatshepsut's death, likely thanks to an earthquake. The words Hatshepsut ordered carved onto the obelisk are still there and read, "I erected them for my father, Amun. They could be seen from the other side of the Nile, their tips gleaming." Graffiti survives near the site of one of Hatshepsut's many building sites. It shows a man standing with an erection, having sex with a female figure who is bent over in front of him. For years, this graffiti has been interpreted as a pornographic dig at Senenmut's relationship with Pharaoh Hatshepsut. However, the female figure in the sketch doesn't wear any royal insignia. It's also worth noting that the forward figure in the graffiti is not shown clearly with breasts, or from the top half, anatomically, the torso clearly of a woman. Well, this could mean it's a play on Hatshepsut's androgynous depiction of herself as a female king. It could be an unknown man or woman. It could just have been a joke that we've overinterpreted. It might, in fact, depict two men having sex, but I'm not really convinced by that. Even if it is supposed to be Senenmut and Hatshepsut, or Hatshepsut and any man, as Senenmut isn't the only candidate, all it tells us is that there was gossip about them, as there usually is about most powerful people. Whatever the private dynamic between Hatshepsut and Senenmut, she trusted his architectural expertise to oversee her mortuary temple. This was to be one of, if not the greatest of her projects, because it would be where she was worshipped after she died. It would ensure the continuity of her legacy, her hold on eternity. Nearly every pharaoh before her had done this, but not all of them had been popular enough in life or impressive enough in death to be widely remembered. As traditional, Hatshepsut picked a spot on the opposite side of the riverbank to Thebes. Where the sun rose, the eastern side of the river, was the city of the living in Thebes. Where the sun set, on the western bank of the river, was the city of the dead, also known as the Theban necropolis. Here, there were privileged villages and towns housing expert workers who constructed the tombs hidden in the valleys. And here too, on the western bank, was where several previous pharaohs had constructed their mortuary temples. One of the greatest pharaohs in Egyptian history, Mentuhotep II, had his mortuary temple built 500 years earlier on a spot on the west bank that we now know by its Arabic name of Deir al-Bahari, the monastery in the north. Hatshepsut called it Jesser Jesseru, the Holy of Holies. It was here that her temple would be built too, cut into the rocks, then stretching down into the valley. An architecturally breathtaking monument to her reign. Worships entered her temple up a ramp between two vast colonnades, one on their left proclaiming Hatshepsut's legacy as a great builder, specifically advertising and boasting about her erection of the great obelisks. The other, to the pilgrim's right, showed Hatshepsut as a warrior crushing the enemies of Egypt, and also as a keen, successful hunter. Passing through, the worshippers entered into a large courtyard dominated by another huge ramp leading up to the chapels. This rank too was flanked by carved scenes from Hatshepsut's life. On the left, the success of the expedition she had authorized to Punt. On the right, her divine birth as Amun's daughter. Inside the temple, there were two chapels and a sanctuary dedicated to Amun, another to honour Amun's temporary incarnation and Hepsut's actual father, Pharaoh Thutmosis I, a chapel to Hathor, the goddess of love and beauty, a chapel to Anubis, jackal-headed god of death, a row of statues portraying Hatshepsut in the guise of Osiris, king of the underworld, and a chapel to the veneration of Hatshepsut herself. The god of death visited the palace when Hatshepsut was about 46, when her only daughter, Princess Neferiri, died. The exact date and cause of the princess priestess's death are both unclear. Hatshepsut's son and heir, Thutmosis III, was often in transit, conducting the junior duties of monarchy while Hatshepsut led the government in the capital. Thutmosis seems to have represented the royal family in the north of Egypt often, attending religious ceremonies in northern cities like Memphis and Heliopolis. In Memphis, his stepmother had funded the creation of a new temple to Ptah, a god associated with crafts and creation who was particularly loved by the people of Memphis. Thutmosis also inspected the Egyptian border fortresses from his military base at Pirenefer. Along with his undoubted military skills, Thutmosis seems to have had a high sex drive and many sexual partners, often visiting the royal harem at the harem palace of Medinet-il-Gharab. From Hatshepsut's perspective, heirs by and from Thutmosis added to her regime's security. Thutmosis also seems to have been an excellent charioteer and hunter, as well as a strong archer, rower, and a very fast runner. The only source of tension between Hatshepsut and Thutmosis may have been over the issue of war. Thutmosis was keen to take the war that had expelled the Hyksos onto their own front door by expanding the Egyptian empire north and east. Hatshepsut, although by no means a pacifist, doesn't seem to have been as keen on war as was her stepson. However, one of the temples she had built was dedicated to worship of the goddess Sekhmet, the lion-headed goddess of war, sometimes known as Pakhet. Sekhmet was a ferocious daughter of the sun, a lioness, a goddess who protected Egypt's borders and gave the pharaohs their victories in war. By building a temple to the worship of Sekhmet, Hatshepsut advertised that she remained devoted to the goddess of war, and war itself, when it was necessary. More and more grand temples continued to spring up under Hatshepsut's watch, tributes to her piety and to the sheer extraordinary wealth she had built in her kingdom. Along with the expansions to Amun's temple in Thebes and the new temple to Ptah in the north, another to Ptah in Thebes, and the aforementioned temple to Sekhmet in the middle of the country, Hatshepsut also commissioned a new temple to the god of wisdom Thoth in the town of Hermopolis, a regional administrative centre, a temple for Hanum, the creator god who had fashioned her on his celestial potter's wheel, was erected on the southern island of Elephantine, where Hatshepsut also had a temple erected to Satet, a hunting goddess who, with her bow and arrow, was believed to guard Egypt's southern borders. Just south of Thebes, in the town of Armant, Hatshepsut erected a temple to Montu, a conquering god popular in Thebes, although in the rest of the country, his cult always struggled to compete with the popularity of Sekhmet's. Hatshepsut's funerary temple at Djeser-Djeseru was finished in Hatshepsut's lifetime. Based on examinations of what may be Hatshepsut's mummy, there is a modern theory that she developed bone cancer, which killed her, aged about 49 or 50 in 1458, after about 21 years on the throne. Her body was mummified, and with Thutmosis III as her chief mourner, she was conducted one last time across the River Nile, to be placed with her treasure in a tomb in the western land of the dead. There, her body rested for 500 years or so, until it was discovered by grave robbers, looted of its objects. Even her mummy was torn from its coffin and hacked open to extract the bejeweled amulets that the priests of Anubis had placed there to help speed her journey to the land of eternity, the underworld. A few priests may have recovered Hatshepsut's mummy, perhaps, and helped hide it with a cache of her relatives' mummies, all of whom had been attacked and stripped and robbed as the Egyptian empire started to fall apart. As the economy collapsed with no money to pay them, the guards at the royal tombs disappeared, and one by one those tombs were found and ransacked by robbers, all except Tutankhamun, saved and hidden by the discarded rubble from another royal tomb that hid his entrance until it was found by an enterprising archaeologist in the 1920s. It's doubtful the robbers knew or cared whose tomb they were invading. By the time her grave was robbed, nobody had heard of Hatshepsut. Maybe a few priests with an interest in history, but beyond that, she had been completely forgotten. In the years immediately after Hatshepsut's death, her stepson had proved as successful in war as she had proved in peace. Thutmosis III was considered for years as one of the most successful warrior kings in ancient history. He's been compared by military historians to Alexander the Great. He's been nicknamed the Napoleon of Egypt in European histories. He went down in Egyptian history as Thutmosis the Great. He led his armies to great victories, and in the eyes of his people, that made him beloved of Sekhmet, scourge of Egypt's enemies, in an era when war was seen by many as a king's supreme test. The wealth accumulated under Hatshepsut skyrocketed under Thutmosis. After the death of his great royal wife, Queen Sutia, Thutmosis promoted his second wife to the top position of chief queen. He continued to marry, even marrying three sisters, Syrian princesses called Manhatta, Manue, and Manuta, as part of a diplomatic peace settlement following his war with their father. Initially, Thutmosis III venerated his stepmother's legacy, even depicting himself in a similar guise in his statues to Hatshepsut. He also spent a fortune completing his stepmother's incomplete monuments and honouring her memory. But as his reign wore on, Thutmosis the Great began to worry about the future. Was Hatshepsut's legacy not so much a blessing as a curse on the royal line? When the time came for Thutmosis to join Hatshepsut in the next life, would one of his wives try to do the same and make herself pharaoh as had Hatshepsut? Having buried his eldest son Amenemhat, the heir to the throne was Thutmosis' younger son Amenhotep. Neurotic about threats to Amenhotep, Thutmosis decided to dismantle some of Hatshepsut's monuments. He also began curtailing the power of the god's wife of Amun to make sure a chief priestess with royal blood did not once again use the temple as a launching pad to the throne. He had the prayers and ceremonies at Hatshepsut's great mortuary temple redirected to worship instead the spirits of her father, Thutmosis I, her husband, Thutmosis II, and her stepson, Thutmosis III. He left her obelisks up and didn't eradicate her name or destroy her name in the way they did with some later pharaohs who were judged heretics. And that meant Thutmosis wasn't attacking Hatshepsut's spirit in the underworld. But he did remove, if not her spirit, then certainly many symbols of her kingship. Facing the fact that the next pharaoh like him might succeed whilst still young, Thutmosis seems to have gone after some of Hatshepsut's political monuments whilst he himself was worrying about his health or confronting his mortality. But then Thutmosis seemed to have a change of heart and stopped this architectural rebranding. Instead, he crowned his son Amenhotep a junior pharaoh in his own lifetime, just as Hatshepsut once had with him. However, when Thutmosis the Great II passed on, dying sometime around 1425, and the throne of Egypt was occupied solely by his son Amenhotep II, the new pharaoh never named a great royal wife. He had wives, the most important of which was Queen Tia, but she was not given the title of Great Royal Wife until her son succeeded Amenhotep as Thutmosis IV and retrospectively gave it to her. And where Amenhotep II had undercut the power of the Great Royal Wife, Thutmosis IV pushed into temporary oblivion the role of God's Wife at the Temple of Amun. The partial erasure of Hatshepsut in death, and in particular of her most visible monuments, by her once loyal stepson, followed by the political concerns of his son and grandson who saw no reason whatsoever to draw attention to Hatshepsut's achievements and in fact felt they had many pragmatic reasons not to, all combined to see Hatshepsut's name and legend dim over time. One of the most successful pharaohs and builder kings in history was covered in a collective amnesia. There would be other queens who wielded great power in Egypt. Nefertiti, wife of Thutmosis's great-grandson. Nefertiti, famously beautiful wife of Ramesses the Great, who was worshipped in her own temples that he had constructed for her. And of course, the Greek-descended pharaoh queens of Egypt like Arsinoe II and Cleopatra VII. But it would take the industry and inquisitiveness of 20th century academics, archaeologists, and scholars before the name Hatshepsut would be retrieved from oblivion to once again be recognized as one of the most remarkable rulers of ancient Egypt. Tune in next week for our episode on the Queen Mother's cousin and how he survived the sinking of a luxury liner that was nicknamed Canada's Titanic. I'm Gareth Russell. Thank you and take care.